This week on Bloodstream, Amy and I are talking about a major investment into more diverse and inclusive clinical trials.
Hey, we'll also discuss the recent Instagram post actor Amanda Fuller shared, opening up about her son's hemophilia B diagnosis.
Welcome to the fam, little blood brother bro. And speaking of hemophilia B and coming out parties, a super prominent member of the hemophilia B community just announced that he's enrolled in a hemophilia B gene therapy clinical trial.
All that, plus the awesome Dr. Mike Callahan joins us to share his hemophilia and sickle cell ASH 2020 highlights.
For me, ASH is about seeing friends and having hallway conversations. And we're missing that, but the science is just as good this year. The sessions have been just as good. Still a great ASH in spite of not being able to see people in person.
Hi, all. I'm Amy Board.
And I'm Patrick James Lynch.
We host the show.
That's true.
We're not doctors.
That's also true. I couldn't do all the schooling.
Yeah, but that's also not the reason you're not. However, just make sure to talk to medical professionals about your medical decisions.
Yeah, medical professionals are to medical decisions as podcast hosts are to...
entertainment and information, my guy. Just like the best of all those hallway conversations during patient meetings.
So thanks for listening, subscribe, and tell a friend about us. And hey, welcome to Bloodstream. Big show today, lots to get to, and I gotta say, that convo with Dr. Mike about ASH 20, I figured it would be interesting and we'd help the audience learn a thing or two, but it kind of blew my mind a little bit.
Oh my gosh, me too. I actually told him in the middle of it that I'm usually super, like, in the know about everything hemophilia, and he blew my mind. He blew my mind.
So we'll get to that along with all that other good stuff we mentioned here at the top, just after I say thank you to Takeda for being the presenting sponsor of the Bloodstream podcast.
Woohoo! Takeda!
Amy is now cheering for them like they are the Broncos. Though Takeda and the Broncos do have just about the same win total for the year, so I guess that's...
Oh my gosh, just get on with it, Lynch. Just move.
Takeda has got a website, bleedingdisorders.com, and that's where you can go to learn all about Takeda's commitment to and resources for the bleeding disorders community. Once again, that is, you're going to want to grab a pen, bleedingdisorders.com. And for their ongoing support of the Bloodstream podcast, I would just like to say thanks, Takeda.
Thank you, Takeda.
All right, sorry for the Broncos dig. I just couldn't resist putting that aside. Amy, how are you?
I'm well. I'm actually well. I'm very excited about this episode. Honest to God, Dr. Mike blew my mind. And it's fun. It's fun to do that circle back. So anyway, I'm really excited for our listeners to kind of hear what came out of ASH, because legit things came out. And also, they do posters, which is a callback to like seventh grade when you had to do posters. So everybody talks about posters, and it's like, I think that's like a visual aid. Like, that's what doctors do.
There's something kind of funny
aids,
about
just like we did in
doctors,
seventh grade. You thought it was worthless. It's not.
It's not at all. In fact, posters and abstracts. And I remember when I first started hearing like from doctors and scientists, it's like, wait, the highest people in like academic research and medical understanding, they show up with posters and something called an abstract. Like, that doesn't sound very specific or helpful. But no, these are the terms and the things that we use.
100%.
All right, so we'll get to that in a little bit, but our first topic for today, Amy teed it up at the top, Amanda Fuller, actor, she had a story in People magazine in June 2019 talking about her struggles getting pregnant as someone with a chronic illness and endometriosis, and then she posted to Instagram just a couple few weeks ago that her son, who was born last year, was born with hemophilia B. In the post, she mentions, of course, it was a shock with no prior family history, and that she and her husband had been working to get pregnant and had their own pregnancy journey, and then it lands in this diagnosis of hemophilia, and how it's been difficult. She mentions some of the struggles with infusing at home and learning to do it themselves, and it's like, yep, yeah, welcome. You are a part of this community now. But the thing that she said that I think, you know, it's obvious, but it's not enough for people in her position to always step forward. Her position, if sharing our story helps even one family out there, it's worth the fear of exposing this open wound. And I think that's beautifully said and very apropos. So thank you to Amanda and her husband and her family for the willingness to step forward. I hope at some point we can maybe bring her on the show to talk about the experience. But
I do too. I mean, it's such a universal... like her reaction and the words she put to it, from my experience watching so many families and mothers, new mothers, go through this. I mean, it's mm-hmm. it feels very universal. It's unfortunately, there's a lot of grief to it. There's almost a death of a dream of you're going to have this healthy baby. It's terrifying. I had a new family that got the diagnosis in the middle of the night, and the night nurse said, "Don't Google it. You know, the hematologist will be there in the morning. Don't Google it." Of course, they Googled it, and it's like terrifying. Right. And
we can't say that. We should just a quick sidebar on that, because that story has hurt a lot. We got to just decide what's the one destination we can send people, because they're going to Google it. So if you don't want them to, you can't say don't Google it. That's like saying don't look down.
I know. And I think it's like, it's the deep googs. Like if you do deep googs, because if you Google hemophilia, because I did too, I'm like, well, you get National Hemophilia Foundation, you get Steps for Living or something, you know, which is like these lovely resources. And so you'll see that. Yeah. You'll see it. But I think blood, you know, uncontrolled, the medication is terrifying. You know, she yeah. you know, kind of alluded to, it just brings out inadequacies in everybody. I mean, you're trying to poke this baby with baby fat that, I mean, it's, you know, even professionals are like, I don't know. And it's terrifying. And I think, putting myself in a caretaker's role, in a mom and a dad and a grandparent and an aunt and uncle, in a community that has this spontaneous, you know, this spontaneous thing that comes out of nowhere, no family history. I think to see it normalized in, you know, a publication like People Magazine, I think is really important. And mm-hmm. I so appreciate people in, I think a lot of celebrities get looked down upon for sharing certain things as it's, you know, attention grabbing. And I understand that, you know, there's some sliver. Sure. But if you are experiencing it, seeing it normalized is so powerful. And so I just, hats off to her. I hope we can get her on the show. She's an actress on the television show Last Man Standing. And just wish her and her husband all the best. That kid is going to thrive. He's going to be great. He's going to thrive, and welcome to the family.
Welcome to the family. All right, so Greg, you got your job now. You got to track down Amanda Fuller and get her on the show. So no pressure, but your job depends on it. JK. All right, so moving on. Thank you, Amanda. Topic number two, we want to talk a bit about diversity and inclusivity in research. So this was an article that caught my and Amy's attention, and it's something we've talked about, why, especially with regard to sickle cell, and I guess maybe more for the Cheat Codes podcast, it comes up than on here, but why this is so important. So I'll turn it over to you, Amy, to kind of give us the context and some of the highlights from this recent story.
Sure. It looks like Bristol-Myers Squibb and the Bristol-Myers Squibb Foundation is committing over $100 million to a diversity and inclusion in research initiative that has several bullet points how they are going to divide the money. It looks like they want to train and develop at least 250 new clinical investigators who are racially and ethnically diverse. We'll have, you know, have already demonstrated commitment to increasing diversity in clinical trials, but to support them financially, I think, is a huge commitment. And they also, of course, want to build capacity in already standing clinical trials. Some of the data that has been shown and is, you know, through the FDA is about 80% of all patients in part of clinical trials right now are white. Black Americans represent only 13% of the U.S. population and only reflect about 7% of participants in clinical trials. So in terms of the racial sphere, this is very exciting. I think one thing that this article and this inclusion, you know, commitment did not mention is the involvement of women in clinical trials. We had Christy Van Horn, who is a public health expert, on Ask the Expert podcast, I think over a year ago, talking about gender bias. And one of the things that she mentioned was that women are not are not in as many clinical trials as men. And if you think about it, our anatomy and our makeup is so, and physiology is so different, and how one medication, you know, works for the male body might work differently in a female body. And so that's interesting to me. However, I do think steps are being made, and this is a phenomenal commitment, and we just wanted you guys to be aware. So I think you can find more information if you go to the FDA website, which I know everybody wants to do after listening to this podcast. Let's go straight to the FDA.gov.
Woohoo! Yeah, FDA.gov.
Anyway, you can find more information about it, but it's a good thing to track and to see if others, you know, join suit. You know, you always need one to do it in the beginning, and to look at others joining suit, I think is important. So anyway,
it's also worth mentioning, if you go to the Bristol Myers website, if you do follow the threads to this story, so to speak, there's also information about applying. So eligible candidates for some of this funding will hold either an MD, MD PhD, DO, or DO PhD, and have an interest in clinical research in the areas of cancer, cardiovascular disease, and immunologic disorders. The applications will open January 2021. If you want to learn more about eligibility and program details, yes, you can go to websites, but here is an email address that you can send stuff to. There's a lot of letters coming up, so you actually will want to grab a pen for this one. dctcdpinfo@nmfonline.org. Certainly going to give that again. D for David, C for Charlie, T for Tom, C for Charlie, D for David, P for Patrick, info@, N for Nancy, M for Mother, F for Fran, don't know why, online.org. If you send an email to that crazy email address, which Amy won't because she is, I'm sorry, I think I just ruined her day by giving that out.
No. I'm just impressed you came up with like all those names. That's really impressive.
Thank you.
I'll do that like for the first two, and then I'll get to a P, and I think like the one thing you shouldn't say that starts with P, and I'll be like, I can't say that.
Well, one thing I am terrible with, though, there's like, you know, alpha, beta, delta, like the, I don't know, I don't know who like officially uses those descriptors, but I kind of go in and out of those. So I'll be, you know, delta, C for Cadillac, T for Toronto, C for cup of soup, like I, so you know, it comes and goes, but anyway, that's way off track.
It was impressive and it was amazing, and everyone listening to this podcast is amazed, trust me, everyone's mouth is open.
All right, well, lastly, before we get to the interview with Dr. Mike, hearing about his takeaways from ASH 20, which sincerely was more than either Amy or I bargained for, I woke up actually this morning to an email from my uncle in Hong Kong, and my uncle in Hong Kong tends to send me these kind of emails every once in a while when there's a hemophilia story that bubbles up to, you know, the mainstream media or international media or financial news. And he's like, I'm sure you're following. But we all, those of us in the community probably all have those people in our lives who, when there is every couple few months or years a hemophilia story, they send it to you. And they don't, I mean, it's very nice, but like 30 people send it to me at the same time. So anyway, so the article that my lovely uncle sent me is from the Irish Times, one of the papers that he likes to keep an eye on. And the title of it is Irish Hemophilia, with the spelling H-A-E. Let's not get into it. Irish hemophilia patients given, quote, functional cure. My favorite descriptor of these like therapies meant to keep us healthy and static, but we can't fully use the capital C word. So functional cure it is. And the article goes on to mention that there are 54 patients worldwide who have participated in a trial for a certain hemophilia B. Actually, I don't know if, it doesn't even look like the article necessarily gets into the hemophilia B part, because that's a little in the weeds for the common folk, but we know that it's a hemophilia B gene therapy clinical trial. There are three of those patients who are in Ireland and identified, and one of them stepped forward, as it were, to announce that he is one of those patients, and that is none other than Brian O'Mahony, the president or CEO, whatever the top-ranking title is, for the Irish Hemophilia Society, previous president of the World Federation of Hemophilia, person living with hemophilia, and generally highly credible, well-regarded international
patient advocate. A legend, I'll say it. He's a legend. Yeah, like,
so this is significant, and he posted to Twitter actually only just this morning, just a few hours ago, about why he made the decision he did. And I would just like to share with you what Brian had to say, because I think in this era of new therapies, and especially when we're talking about something that's still in the experimental stage, which clinical trials are part of the experimental process, the investigative process. But someone to have with his standing, it's very interesting to me. So here's what Brian said. I have been asked why I decided to participate in a gene therapy clinical trial. I have followed the science and developments for many years. Hemophilia Society of Ireland organized several meetings specifically on gene therapy for members since 2013 to discuss clinical trials. My view, the Factor IX trials were showing good factor expression and indications of durability of probably at least 10 years. My reasons for participating. 1. Reasonable chance of significant factor expression. 2. Hoped for long, at least 10 years, duration of expression. 3. No requirement for regular intravenous factor infusions. That's a big one. 4. Hoped to see less chronic joint pain. 5. Less time required thinking about and dealing with my own hemophilia. I was aware of potential for short-term or long-term adverse events. I was hoping for a good outcome, but mentally prepared for a poor or suboptimal outcome. That seems like an important thing to prepare yourself for. I have lived with severe hemophilia for 62 years. I wanted to try a life without severe hemophilia. My experience to date after 9 months is very good. Factor expression at or near normal, no adverse events, no steroids, less chronic pain. I am walking 5 to 8 kilometers most days, which as an American, I haven't a clue what that means. The full benefit will not be apparent until 2021, as first year has very significant follow-up visits. My increased fitness and health due not just to gene therapy, but also to recovery post-knee replacement in 2018, and not having a crazy travel schedule this year. I have no regrets about taking gene therapy, but as an irreversible therapy, decision has to be fully informed. We are looking at additional gene therapy clinical trials in hemophilia, and therapies should be licensed by 2022. We will work to make these amazing therapies an option for adults with severe hemophilia in Ireland. So great, specific, to-the-point breakdown by someone who's in a great position to give it.
100%. So informed, you know, involved in the community and did his due diligence. And really, that's all we're asking of each patient. It's a personal choice. There's some, just like you have mentioned multiple times, expectation management, being aware of what that expression looks like, being aware of the data. You might not be comfortable doing it now, and just waiting. That's great and fine. Mm-hmm. And prudent, and there's also this flip side. My favorite thing he said in that whole thing is, you know, I'm 62, in his 60s, and I wanted to try a time where I didn't have severe hemophilia. Like, I get goosebumps, and I just, like, you know, you're gonna have choice in your life. Amanda Fuller, your son, is gonna have choice in his life. To each of you, thrive. It's great. What a gift he opened up and shared that. That's important. You know, hearing those stories are so important, almost more than the scientific data, or as important as the scientific data.
As important as the scientific data, which, Amy, beautiful transition, because as I too would love to spend time on this, but I think we would just be repeating the points. Brian, good for you. I'm glad you're getting a shot at this life without hemophilia. Now that you're talking about it, I hope you'll keep talking about it, because your point of view and experience, well articulated, is uniquely valuable, just to be honest. So thank you. And with that, let's talk a little data with somebody who's expert in crunching the data. He does the Red Blood Cell Research Review on the Cheat Codes podcast and a bunch of other stuff. So let's get into it and chop it up with Dr. Mike, all about ASH 2020. All right, Amy and I are now joined by, he's a pediatric hematologist. He's the associate professor of pediatric hematology and oncology at Wayne State University. He's the director of the Sickle Cell Center, the Children's Hospital of Michigan, but we know him best as co-host of Cheat Codes, a Sickle Cell podcast. I'm speaking, of course, about Dr. Mike Callahan. Hey, Dr. Mike, how you doing?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, Patrick?
Doing pretty well as well, adjusting to just how early it gets dark these days, as we were chatting about briefly here off mic before we started. I appreciate that we're catching you as Ash is wrapping up. We're recording this on Monday, so there's actually still, I think, about a day and a half or so, maybe a little bit less, at the time we're catching you. So let's jump right in. You've got a foot in the hemophilia world, a foot in the sickle cell world. Let's start with hemophilia. What has been striking to you? What's maybe one of the bigger updates or two coming out of Ash, in your opinion?
Yeah, so I think just this afternoon, probably the abstract that got the biggest buzz in hemophilia world was presented by Steve Pipe. And this was one of the late breaking abstracts. So for ASH, you have to put your data in pretty early, but they have a separate path for like really exciting things that don't have data at the time. And this was the uniQure HOPE3 hemophilia B gene therapy study. And uniQure did a phase one study, but they used a factor nine gene, just a native factor nine gene. And it was pretty successful. They actually had data at this in a separate abstract of about 4 years of follow-up, and people's levels have stayed pretty steady in the 5 to 10 range, which was exciting at the time. But we keep, with like Lucy with the football, moving the goalposts for the gene therapy. Sure. And so they did a phase three study where they put in a mutated factor nine called factor nine Padua that has many fold higher activity. So for the same amount of protein, you get more clotting activity. And they have 26 weeks of readout on about 50 patients now. It looked good. So the average factor levels were up around 40%. And people were having not a lot of bleeding, as you might expect with those levels. It's always hard in these first parts of these gene therapy studies, because at first the gene therapy is not doing anything. So if you have a breakthrough bleed, right, it's kind of expected. Most of the patients were not having breakthrough bleeding at all. And the amount of factor used was down by like 90%. And I think one thing that's hampered gene therapy is a lot of people have antibodies against the virus capsid, so they're not eligible for the gene therapy because their body would presumably clear the virus before it could work. Right. And this study actually dosed those people. So even people who had pre-existing antibodies were eligible for the study, I think, to a certain point. Okay. And all but one of those patients with the pre-existing antibodies had a good response. So that patient had the highest titer. I think he had like a 1 to 3200 titer. So you could dilute his blood out 3200 fold and he still had an antibody that you could detect. And that patient didn't get a lot of factor expression. I think he didn't get above 1%. But there were several other patients in the study who had those antibodies, got dosed and did well. And they said I didn't see the granular data here, but they said they did just as well as everybody else. So that was exciting.
Is that because of the Padua variant, or what do we attribute that to?
You know, no, it was interesting. Maybe two, 3 years ago, I was at a WFH meeting on new therapies in hemophilia in Montreal, and they presented data from their phase one trial. And on the phase one trial, they had used one assay to measure antibodies against the virus and found that people didn't have them that they put in the study. Then they said, ooh, that wasn't the right assay. They switched to a more sensitive assay. And they found that a lot of the people that they had dosed on that study actually had pretty significant antibody titers, but had a good response. So they said, you know, maybe this isn't as important as we thought. And so on their phase three trial, they said, we're going to allow people to come in who have these antibodies. So I think that's a little bit innovative, because, you know, that's been a drawback of gene therapy, is that maybe a lot of people would be ineligible because they have these antibodies.
Yeah, we've talked about that a fair amount, the expectation management that we're just not used to having when there's a new product available. There's a whole new expectation management game, but this sounds like perhaps it's, to your point, not the consideration that we thought it was just a little while ago.
Yeah, I think this changes that conversation a little bit. It's obviously early days in this study. They've got 26 weeks of data, but it's really promising. Right. And I think that would be great for the community and probably across gene therapies. It could be just a uniQure gene therapy unique thing, but I think there's potential that it would be across gene therapies, that the pre-existing antibodies aren't as important as we thought.
Interesting. So I know you also presented a number of abstracts during the meeting. Do you want to tell us a little bit about all any or one of those?
Sure. So I think hemophilia related, I presented a poster on Sunday that covered all of the Haven studies extension trials. So the Haven 1 study was inhibitor patients who were adults and adolescents. And there was a pediatric study and non-inhibitor study.
Can you remind
study.
People what the Haven study is, just like the headline?
Sure. So Haven 1 was testing emicizumab prophylaxis in people with inhibitors who were age 12 and older. Haven 2 was inhibitor patients who were under 12. Haven 3 looked at weekly or every 2 week dosing in non-inhibitor patients. And then Haven 4 looked at every 4 week dosing in adolescent and adult inhibitor and non-inhibitor patients. And all of those have been published. Haven 1 and 3 in the New England Journal, and Haven 2 in Blood, and Haven 4 in Lancet Hematology. And the results, I think, were pretty impressive. There was a low bleed rate. The drug was safe and well tolerated, and the dosing regimen was pretty infrequent. You could go once a week or out to every 4 weeks sub Q. But what we noticed was after the primary endpoints of the study, which were for most of the studies 24 weeks, for Haven 2 it was 52 weeks, that's where they did the analysis and they said, here's the bleed rate on emicizumab, here's the bleed rate in the placebo arm, and that was the comparison, and that's what they published. But those patients continued on the drug and continued on the study until the drug became commercially available in their country and they were able to get it, and we continued to collect data. So we now have data across the Haven studies on 400 patients, and the average patient was on for about 2.5 years at that point. So we have about a thousand patient years of data. And what we saw was that, you know, during that first 6 months, which was mostly what we reported in the studies, the bleed rate was low, you know, 1.7, 1.9 bleeds per year, something like that on average, with, you know, maybe close to 70% of patients not having any bleeds. In subsequent 6 month periods, the bleed rates came down. So during the next 24 weeks, the bleed rate was like 0.7 across the studies, and continued to stay very low. And that was true in the adult studies, in the pediatric studies, in the inhibitor studies, and the non-inhibitor studies. So what we think is happening is probably two things. One is that if you have a lot of bleeding in your joints, there's a lot of inflammation, it puts you at more risk of bleeding. So when you go on emicizumab and you have less bleeding, it quiets those joints down and you're less likely to bleed. And some of it, I think, is adapting to the new treatment and building confidence in it. So maybe early on in the study, you had a little bit of knee pain and you said, oh, that's a bleed, I'll treat it right away. And later on you said, I've had a knee pain like this that I didn't treat and it went away without anything. It could just be arthritis or something. And so you'd be less likely to treat it later on. So I think the combination of those two things led to a lower bleed rate over time.
So, nothing necessarily to do with the expression of emicizumab itself, it sounds like.
No, because they continued to monitor the levels and the pharmacokinetics, and it seemed pretty steady. So it doesn't look like you're building up levels over time or anything like that. It's I think just a combination of those things. And I think the other important thing about that, was to look at the safety. You know, 6 months, you're going to see some safety signal. Is that going to be the same thing that you see over time? Are you going to have new side effects? And pleasantly, we didn't see any. So the most common things were still injection site reactions. I think little less than 30% of people experienced in at least one injection site reaction, usually pain, swelling, itchiness at the site. In Haven 1, there were, you know, pretty high profile blood clotting events and this thing called thrombotic microangiopathy that happened when people got high doses of APCC. And we didn't see any more of those. I think that had mostly to do with, you know, once we identified that the drug interaction was the cause of that, we put in a mitigation strategy and said, don't use those high doses of APCC while you're on emicizumab. And that seems to have worked. It seems like we haven't had any more of those events in those patients.
Well, that's really encouraging to hear. To your point, you know, we have only the data we have when something first comes out. And now the follow-on data having, I think you said 1,000 patient years of experience. I mean, that's a lot of data when thinking about something that's only been out for a couple few years, put in that framework, it does immediately kind of gives just me a greater sense of confidence. So thank you for sharing that. And I would love to ask you more questions about that.
Sure. Well, if people are interested, it's published in Blood today, so they can read the article.
There you go. Okay, it's published in Blood, and you can find Dr. Callahan's name on there. But yeah, with the few minutes that we have remaining, I do want to ask you about the world of sickle cell as well, because as much is going on in hemophilia, there's at least as much happening in sickle cell. So what can you share with us in the few minutes we have about sickle cell at ASH?
Sure. So I think there's a tremendous buzz around sickle cell, which, you know, hemophilia, we've been blessed with a lot of enthusiasm and corporate investment and studies for years. And sickle cell is pretty new to us, and there was a lot of stuff at ASH this year. So I think probably the biggest scientific paper was one of the plenary papers. So they picked the six best abstracts to present at the plenaries, and this was one of them. And it was from CRISPR and Vertex. They partnered on a drug that's got a catchy name, like CTX001. And this is a CRISPR-Cas9 gene therapy. So they take stem cells from patients, and then they manipulate them with this CRISPR that actually goes in and edits their DNA. And this edited thing called BCL11 that makes the cells make fetal hemoglobin that doesn't sickle. And then they basically do a bone marrow transplant, but instead of getting a bone marrow transplant donor, you get your own stem cells back. And so they did this in thalassemia patients and sickle cell patients, and the results were impressive. The patient's hemoglobins are up considerably. It's mostly fetal hemoglobin. They're not having sickle cell pain crises. The thalassemia patients were not needing transfusions. The people with thalassemia usually need transfusions their whole life. So so it was a really, you know, early days, but really exciting data. And then I think the other thing that was great about this particular ASH is I think in this, you know, George Floyd 2020 Black Lives Matter year, there was really an emphasis on addressing race around sickle cell, but just in general too. So there was a great session with Dr. Wally Smith, who we've had on the Cheat Codes podcast, and is just a great guy, talking about addressing racial bias. And Dr. Z, my podcast co-host, had a special session. They flew in a film crew, and he did like a TED-like talk about racial bias and sickle cell disease. And there was just a fantastic question and answer. So really a lot of other stuff going on in sickle cell and bleeding disorders. But it's been a funny ASH, because for me, ASH is about seeing friends and having hallway conversations and kicking around ideas. And we're missing that, but the science is just as good this year. The sessions have been just as good. The virtual platforms really worked out well. And I think, you know, still a great ASH in spite of not being able to see people in person.
So is there anything coming out of ASH going into 2021, both with regard to hemophilia and sickle cell, that you in particular are keeping an eye on, say, for the first few months of next year to see how this thing develops or see what we hear about that thing? Well, what's on your mind?
Yeah, so there were a few things. There was something I hadn't seen too much in past ASH meetings, where people put in abstracts about clinical trials that haven't started yet. So they were sort of advertising and explaining their clinical trial. And Dr. Amy Shapiro from IHTC had a poster about a new therapy from a company called Sigilon. I don't know if you've talked about these, but they're sort of little cell spheres that produce factor VIII, and they can inject them into people's abdomens, and they're like, you know, little factor factories. And this works really well in mice. And there, you can add however many spheres you need and sort of titrate the levels, and those things are in your body always making factor. So it's almost like a little insulin pump for hemophilia or something like that. So the trials haven't started yet, but it looks like they're going to start soon. And they had, you know, the 18 patient phase one trial inclusion exclusion criteria. So that's definitely something I'm going to be watching. I think
Amy's eyes are lighting up. I don't know if you can see this, Dr. Mike, but Amy is having quite an experience as she processes that information.
I feel a little cocky of like knowing the things that are like in the pipe, and that one came out of left field. That's great.
same.
Yeah, Sigilon. It's pretty neat. I've heard about it for a couple of years, you know, at scientific meetings, but it sounds like it's going into people. There's some crazy. There's one that's like a little pill that you swallow. I can't think of the name of the company. And the pill almost shoots out little hairs that go into your intestines and inject factor. They've made it for insulin. So you could take your factor as like a pill and it like injects it into you. They're so small that it, you know, you don't feel the needle or, you know, it just goes right through you. But there's just incredible
next
technology.
Level stuff.
Yeah.
So yeah, maybe, no kidding.
Maybe we'll have orally delivered factor too. Whew. Yeah. And then I, you know, Ty Buckner had a nice presentation about Athens 7. This is like a new therapy sort of surveillance study. And they have 350 patients on now and really, I think, collecting good data. And I think this kind of study is going to be so important as we get all these new therapies to track outcomes over time and look for safety side effects, signals, especially things like gene therapy. So I thought that was really good. And then the probe people from WFH, like Mark Skinner and Declan and that group had a really nice quality of life study comparing. I loved this. They had people with hemophilia, which we do that a lot now, PWH. Uh-huh. Then they had PWONB. And I was like, what is that? And
yeah.
I looked at it and it's people with no bleeding disorder. So,
of course.
So I'm a PWONB.
I am too, Dr. Mike. I
appreciate that they that they went not with the people without hemophilia, but they went that extra step to make it as inclusive as possible. People without a bleeding disorder. Kudos, probe. Kudos.
Yeah, it was very good. So I think there's probably 100 other things that that we could talk about, but those were the things that caught my eye. And I'm, you know, the other thing that's hard about ASH is I'm at home with my 5 kids going to take pictures with Santa Claus. And so trying to catch all of these sessions has been a little challenge.
Yeah, I imagine. Well, hopefully your colleague has been able to help field some of it so that between the two of you, you can capture the most important stuff.
For sure.
If you're not already a listener, you can hear Dr. Mike and Dr. Z at least twice a month over on the Cheat Codes podcast. You'll find it wherever you listen to podcasts. Please do go subscribe and share the Cheat Codes podcast. And Dr. Mike, I'm sure we'll have you back on sooner than not, but thank you so much for providing that bit of an overview. That's really exciting to hear.
That'd be great.
What's going on?
I always love listening to the Bloodstream podcast, so thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure. It's a pleasure. Take care.
Thank you, Dr. Mike.
Thank you, Dr. Mike Callahan, for joining us. You can check out Dr. Mike and Dr. Z every other Tuesday on Cheat Codes, a sickle cell podcast, which really is as entertaining as it is informative. He and Dr. Z really enjoy doing the pod together, and they're nerdy, outspoken experts, so it's perfect.
Next week, PJL and I will be joined once again by recent guest, and this is 100% the accurate description of him, fan favorite, Nathan Schaefer, who is the Senior Policy Director at the National Hemophilia Foundation. He is joined by his colleague, Bill Roby, to talk state policy stuff. Following up from our talk several weeks ago around the election, around advocacy and policy at the federal level, this conversation will hone in on the state side of things. So make sure you're subscribed to Bloodstream in order to get that episode as soon as it goes live.
Thank you, Amy. Thank you all for listening. Thanks to CADA for being the presenting sponsor of the Bloodstream podcast, bleedingdisorders.com to learn more about them. And that is all for this episode. Have a bleeding disorders or health topic that you would like to hear us discuss? Is there an expert or guest that you're dying to hear from? Want to inquire about casting opportunities for Bloodstream's narrative and docu-styled podcast series? Email us at mailbag@bloodstreammedia.com or connect with Bloodstream Media on social media. You'll find Bloodstream Media on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, or you can follow Amy Board or Patrick James Lynch on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or LinkedIn. Shout out to all the committed LinkedIn users out there. It's a platform that's growing. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. Check out the program notes for this episode in your podcast player or on bloodstreammedia.com, where you'll find links and information related to the various stories and segments featured on this episode. I am your host, Patrick James Lynch.
And I am that other host commonly known as Amy Board.
Hardly anything common about you, Bordeaux. That's all for now. So until next time, take self-care of yourself. Bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody.